combat homelessness. Saturday, April 1st, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Metropolitan College, located at 463 East 149th Street in the Bronx. For more information, please email oe.citywidehousingconference@gmail.com or call 929-367-8490.
Earth Day is Saturday, April 22nd, and it's Planet Heart's 10th anniversary of World Peace Earth Day, celebrating our planet, healing our heart. A conscious spiritual community gathering in unity with special presenters that will honor our Earth and New Earth with inspirational talks, live music, performances, and ceremony. That's Saturday, April 22nd, from 6:30 p.m. sharp till 10 p.m. at the Church of St. Paul and St. Andrew, 263 West 86th Street at the corner of West End Avenue. Doors open at 6 p.m. For details and information, go to planetheart.org or call 212-222-5432.
And you are listening to radio station WBAI in New York, where the time is just about 8 o'clock on a Wednesday. And that means it's time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. From Billy Bump for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. From Billy Bump.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein joining you tonight, joined by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
I'm here. Hi.
Our resident legal expert, Alex, will be joining us tonight.
Здравствуйте, друзья.
And hopefully getting out of that mode. And
sorry, I thought we were broadcasting the original Russian tonight.
Trump is not in the audience, so don't worry about
good
that.
Good evening, friend.
And from somewhere in the world, Bernie S. Bernie S., he's not with us. You can see him.
Hello. It would be helpful if I had my mute. It would be helpful if I had my mute button turned
yes,
off.
Yes.
greetings from northeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay. Good. Northeastern Pennsylvania. I know where that is. We are back for another action-packed edition of Off the Hook, talking about technological issues, of which there are many. All sorts of social events taking place in the hacker world. We'll be going through quite a bit of that. I do have to say. We're going to be releasing the spring issue within the next week, and there have been a kind of a combination of reactions from people that have seen it so far. I don't want to get into details. We really can't get into details, but if you have a heart condition, it's probably best not to look at it without preparing yourself for it. Because it's going to be something else. I'm very proud of what people have put together here. I don't want to say anymore. Just in a week, it's going to be a little bit different around here. I guess that's probably the best way to say it.
Well, I'm excited.
Yeah, we should be. We should be excited. You can do a lot with words and with information, and that's something the hacker community has known about for a long time. But regardless, we're talking about other things tonight. I guess first and foremost, regarding the show, regarding Off the Hook, we want to thank everybody who pledged during the last fun drive, the winter fun drive. And it's going to be a while before the spring fun drive begins, so don't worry about that. Good news, we have, I believe, dealt with all the previous premium issues from previous fun drives. Rob, you have an update on that, right?
Yes, indeed. Everyone who was waiting on the USB drives from fundraisers past, not the most recent one, because we still have to send those out, but from fundraisers past, if you were waiting for one of the older USB drives, they should all have been mailed out and sent out.
Except for that one guy.
Apart from one.
Yeah,
because it's
troublemaker.
It's being sent to the UK and...
what do you think you are?
And so it takes a little more oomph, but
the system here couldn't handle that or something. They couldn't handle mailing to the United Kingdom, so our general manager is actually going to the post office himself.
Yeah, I think the system was confused by Brexit, or maybe it's just upset.
It's just the beginning, folks. Get used to it. So we're sorry about that, but that should be it as far as the things that have been in backlog mode. And as far as what we've just done for the winter fun drive, we had your paintings first week. Those should all have been delivered. So if you pledge for one of those and paid, you should have that already. It should be, in fact, framed and hanging proudly in your home or office.
We've heard from a number of people who've received them and been just really excited and blown away by the artistry.
Yeah.
So thank you for that again, Rob. It's an exciting thank you gift, and really, the station is better for that contribution. You
absolutely
made.
Well, that makes me very happy. And of course, if you've got one of these, whether it's the most recent set of paintings or one of my older sets, because I've done that a few times on this program, we'd love to see a picture. If you've got it displayed somewhere, if you'd like to share that with us, send it email it on up to us, oth@2600.com.
And these paintings that you made are of all different kinds of phones, and they're really
and
you found a whole lot of different kinds, which are pretty amazing. So whatever you have, it's unique. No one else has that.
All with interesting stories, and many people recognize these phones from maybe growing up or the cultural artifacts like movies and TV shows that may have featured them. But
yeah,
it's suffice to say, really, really a cool project.
We have one hanging in the 2600 facility.
We do.
And it's Kyle set it up so that it looks, you know, like a museum, where basically you have the painting hanging up and then you have a little rectangular blurb about it, you know, tastefully distanced away from it, below it.
Right. Yeah. Rob included a little synopsis of what it is about. Mm-hmm. And so we... stapled that or fixed it right next to where the actual portrait or canvas painting itself is. And I think ours was the one that we have is from the Doctor Who series. It's based on the TARDIS itself, I think, box.
Not the actual TARDIS, but the original police box, which was a type of phone booth that used to be a regular sight around England. And when Doctor Who came along, they used this common sight as the shape of their main character's time machine. But these phone booths did serve a purpose. They were metropolitan police boxes, and they were basically phone booth shaped, but they had a telephone in them with which you could contact the police, with which cops on the beat could contact their base and get orders and stuff. This was before police had easy access to portable radios, so this was a way for everyone to keep in touch in those days.
Not unlike fireboxes you'd see in New York, which are still in existence, but police boxes, fireboxes, they're common.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I said it backwards. It was the utility of it as a police tool that then had it become adapted in the series as part of this this fictional vehicle.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in alternative phone networks. Like, that's kind of an alternative phone network, the police box, the firebox. But there's also the train phone box. You ever go to a train station, you see this really ancient phone just sort of hanging out on the tracks. Mm-hmm. And that's what trainmen would use to communicate with a different station or the master control or whatever. And, it, you know, they weren't dialing numbers. They were picking up, or they might have been dialing numbers within their network, but sometimes it's just a hotline directly to a particular place.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And if you'd like to see any of these phones, if you didn't get to get one, you can see them on my art blog, which is robtfirefly.tumblr.com, or on my site robvincent.net. And I haven't put the latest batch up yet, including the one you've got. I have to post those photos probably this weekend.
But we still haven't gotten through the announcement we want to make. Okay, so yeah, everything has been sent out as far as that goes. But we had two other weeks of the recently concluded winter fun drive. One where we had a flash drive of Hope 11 talks that people pledged for, and one where Kevin Mitnick was in the studio, and we had his new book, autograph book, and those are ready to go out. But we need to make sure that people have fulfilled their pledges. So what we are going to do next week, 1 week from today, we are going to get the list of names and addresses of people who have pledged and paid, and we are going to send them out ourselves. That way you're guaranteed there won't be any delays. But if you haven't paid yet, you better hurry up and pay, because your name won't be on that list when we ask for it next week if you don't. So hopefully this is an unnecessary announcement and people have already paid, because we want to get that taken care of so that we have nothing left, and that the next fund drive, when it comes up in May, we can start on a completely fresh slate and do amazingly well.
And that would be awesome. Of course, if you are by some mishap still waiting for one of the older premiums, get in touch with us, oth@2600.com, and tell us what you're waiting for.
Yeah, and please, you know, if it's 10 years ago, you know, there's only so much we can do, but hopefully it's more recent than that. All right, speaking of England, Bernie, I know you forwarded us this story, which I thought was kind of interesting, about the new $1 coins in the UK that have a hidden security feature to make it difficult to counterfeit. How many people out there counterfeit coins? Is that a thing?
Apparently, I didn't realize it, but apparently this is a big deal in the UK.
Wow.
Counterfeit £1 coins. What's a pound worth about now?
A little over $1.
Well, it depends. With Brexit and all, it's going down fast. I think it's about 120, 130. It used to be $2.
That's what I would have guessed. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, apparently, this is a big deal, counterfeit pound coins. You'd think it'd be easier to do. Maybe they don't even have £1 notes anymore. But apparently, you know, counterfeiters have found an easy way to stamp these things out. Uh-huh. And now the new one is got, like, it's multi-sided. What is it, like 11 sides or something? And it has a lot of anti-counterfeiting features, including one rumored feature which allows it to be detected as legitimate or not from without even touching it. It's like some, I don't know if it's actually RFID or something like that. RFID, I really wonder if these £1 coins have individual addresses, which would make it really interesting from a money tracking standpoint.
But that's absolutely the kind of thing that IPv6 and these new technologies would allow.
Okay,
because
wait,
there's
now,
so many addresses.
IPs for every single pound coin out there? Is that what we're suggesting here?
Sure.
Wow.
I mean, that's one use, yeah.
Uh-huh. And they all have little websites, and they tell, I've been over here, like, where's George, except with every single... Wow, okay, that's the world we're moving into, I guess, with unlimited amounts of IP addresses. We could do things like that, but I kind of doubt that's what's happening here.
Well, I don't think these are IP addresses embedded in the coins.
No.
There may be, you know, some sort of unique identifier in each coin. It's still kind of fuzzy. People haven't... They just came out, like, yesterday, these coins, and people are trying to determine what what's been reported in the mainstream media in the UK is that these coins can be their authenticity can be detected from afar, and by afar I mean like maybe a few inches away, as opposed to you know, like physically touching it or looking at it with a magnifying glass. So I'm really interested. I'm sure we'll know by next week's show what the electronic innards are on these coins, if any.
And yeah, that's maybe a listener could send us one of these too. That would be
great.
Awesome, especially if a lot of listeners sent them to us. But for those of who have never come in contact with a pound coin, I imagine a lot of people who haven't traveled might not have seen one. They're unlike anything that we have in this country. I'm talking about the old ones. They're thick. When you drop them, they don't really sound like coins. They sound like stones. They just have this feeling of value to them. And these new ones have, as Bernie mentioned, multi-sides. I believe 12 sides is what they have. What that means is along the rim, basically it's kind of like a pentagon thing, except a lot more than that. It's not round. It's not circular. So there's that. And I haven't seen these new ones yet. I haven't actually held one. I'd like to see what they're actually like. But they definitely have more of a value sense to them than coins that we're used to in this country, and that's including dollar coins that we never seem to be able to get right.
Yeah, as somebody who just recently moved back from England last year, I can attest, Bernie, there are no such things as one-pound notes anymore. The one-pound coin is really commonly used, and as Emmanuel noted, you know, it does have a certain heft in your hand, and that's certainly how you would determine. You can put your hand in your pocket and figure out how many pound coins you have very, very easily, mm-hmm. as opposed to something like quarters. So I wonder if this new currency is going to maintain that sort of heft, you know, that was characteristic of these one-pound coins. They certainly did carry a lot of value. This is a big innovation for them.
And if you're ever being mugged in an alley, you can use these as weapons. They're heavy. So if you throw them at your attacker, it will hurt. They'll get what they want. They'll get the money. I mean, everybody wins, I guess, because you're protecting yourself and they're getting what they're requesting. But, you know, try that with a quarter. It's not going to work.
Certainly not.
Yeah. I wish we had a nice thick coin, though. But this whole RFID possibility and security features.
It's got multiple security features, too, yeah. Right? Not just the near-field communication design. Like, there's other, I think, holographic etching and all kinds of other things.
Well, they say it's a hidden security feature.
Yes, a lot. Yeah, maybe okay, stuff but if they're it's, not
if
talking
it's,
about.
If it's hidden, people don't know about it, then how do people know when they've been given a counterfeit coin? You kind of have to share the information, right? Otherwise, what good is it going to do you?
That's a good point.
What, nobody thought of this?
No. No, right? I think you're the first one.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, here's something else to bounce off people. As of October 15th, the old pound coins are going to be worthless. Well, not worthless, but shops will be under no obligation to take them. How about that? Imagine if they did that here. Imagine if they just said, you know what, any dime before 1964, we're not taking anymore. People, it would be panicked, yeah, mass panic.
That's crazy. I think there's going to be a backlash. Or there may be riots.
So after that day, you can still go to the bank and redeem it there. These are going to be lighter than the old coin. They're going to be 8.75 grams. They're going to be thinner than the old coin, 2.8 millimeters. They're going to be larger than the old coin, 23.43 millimeters. And there's going to be about 23 per person entered into circulation, 1.5 billion in total. And old one-pound coins will be melted down to make new ones. Yeah, so it's really a passing of the torch here. If you want to preserve your one-pound coins, again, send those to us, and we'll give them a happy home here, and they will never be melted down. So that's interesting.
Well, I think they're getting it all wrong here, and I think that the reason why we've never really had, I think, a workable $1 type coin. So you think about what they did in England, which is the one-pound coin isn't necessarily proportional in size to the value, because the one-pound coin is smaller
right.
than a 10p. It's larger than a 5p, but it's smaller than a 10p.
You're talking about pence when you say 10p.
That's
why I make sure
10p.
People know that.
That's
okay.
Right, yeah. So the 10p is larger in circumference, I guess, or diameter, both, than the one-pound coin. So it's this unique thing that's in your pocket. Now they're making it larger and lighter, which totally cuts against the feeling of the pound that you have currently or had currently. So I think it's I think they're making a mistake. I think they're going to make the mistake that we made in trying to initiate a $1 currency.
Well, one difference to what they're doing to what we tried to do most recently with the golden dollars, which never really went anywhere, is we tried to instigate a new dollar coin that had the same measurements and weight as the previous attempt at a dollar coin, which was the when were they from? The Susan B. Anthony's.
Right.
From the 1970s. And that was done at the behest of things like the vending machine industry, who didn't want to have to design for a new coin. They could just use the designs they had for the old one. Also, the old dollars were still in circulation, especially if you've ever bought tickets from an MTA vending machine in cash, and you know how many of those you would get back. So it was designing the new coin to the specs of the old one, and so there was no need to devalue the old ones or switch them out or anything, because they were all still valid dollars.
It's the vending machine, and it's always an evil industry that keeps us from making progress. The oil industry or the broadcasting industry, even, there are all kinds of things we can say about that. But yeah, the vending machine industry, they're the ones preventing us from having a coin that actually is different than a quarter, because the dollar coins look a lot like quarters to many people.
Well, when they brought in the Sacagaweas, I was working in the evil industry. I was running an arcade at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we got everything ready. We got everything ready to take the new dollars, and we're all excited. Okay, we're going to start getting... No one freaking used them.
Wow. Wow.
Nobody but the Long Island Railroad giving you change, right?
Also, yeah, the transit, I would also add.
The half-dollar pieces, you still get those, right? The big JFK ones, sure. Those are kind of cool. No one uses them, I know, but you still can get them from those machines.
That's right.
Oh, occasionally, maybe, from a machine.
And what you got there, Kyle? You got a bunch of $2 bills?
Yeah.
You collect those, too?
Well, Rob's point, I was going to add that, like, the dollar coin is, as he said, ill used, but it is still around, and they do issue different versions and series continually. It's just the transit change is pretty much the only place where you get it. A lot of businesses don't necessarily, they just want to make a dollar, like make that with change. They're not necessarily trying to have this alternative to a dollar bill running alongside it, which we are already made the distinction in the UK. They sort of headed that off by removing the bills, the pound bill note.
I think we're past the point where we should have a dollar coin. I think it should be like in Canada, where there's a $2 coin. They call it the toonies.
That would be cool.
But wouldn't that threaten your precious $2 bills that you carry with you everywhere?
And that is absolutely right. It goes right to the similar role that the $2 bill has, mm-hmm. where you don't really see it that often, but it is still there. It is sometimes even, I think, printed by one or the other reserve bank every now and then. Not a lot and not all the time, but it is still something that is in circulation and used for all kinds of different reasons.
You get all kinds of reactions when you use your $2 bills in various transactions. What's a sampling of the kind of response you might get?
Well, it's usually people want to point out that you're using it. I think that's the most they want to initiate.
As if you didn't know.
Exactly. Like you get recognized if you use these kinds of bills, and it's really if you're being a little bit playful with the denominations, because it's an unusual denomination, meaning you had to do something to get that or to be able to consistently use them. You sort of have to ask around. You don't get them from ATMs and so on. So it does sort of open up this conversation, and people usually have all kinds of things to say. They like them, they marvel at them, and it's really kind of an interesting thing to take overseas because it's unique and not a bill that people usually talk about or are aware of that even exists when they're looking into our country from the outside.
Can I ask how you get yours?
I don't know if I should say.
Well, I don't. It's not really that hard.
I just ask. I go inside banks, and usually they cooperate.
Uh-huh.
Are you holding a weapon?
I didn't want to talk about this.
No.
I go
ask for $1,000 in twos.
Let me be clear. I exchange currency for these notes. But yeah, you could just go in anywhere, and usually tellers, if you want to talk denominations with tellers, they will be so accommodating, because normally people don't ask for it. It's like getting a ceramic cup at Starbucks. They're not people like are used to getting their coffee squirted into a paper cup.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not at all so they just accept whatever the machine is giving them. But if you ask a teller to do something regarding the denominations, it's very specific. They do it all the time with like merchants, people, small businesses and stuff. So when a sort of average person asks something that's sort of unique, like for a bunch of dollar coins or something like that, it's a unique thing. And again, you get this sort of interesting conversation, but generally most banks will accommodate and figure something out.
We've never had
a
conversation like this before. We're talking about money and denominations and coin collecting and things like that. But it is interesting.
It is a security instrument.
You notice all sorts of things written on the bills.
There are security documents, mm-hmm. and financial instruments.
And also, you know, you can get things from the past, too. You can get silver certificates instead of bills.
They have different printing, yeah.
Yeah, so you might just get one of those by complete chance.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of $2 bills, I used to have a bunch of $2 bills. You know the circular thing? I'm using the wrong terms. That's green. Mine was red. It was from the 1950s, yeah. And I lost them. I'm really upset at this, but I used to have a bunch of those.
I've recently got a couple of those. But it's really kind of fascinating. There's a lot of other issues regarding finance. I mean, virtual currencies and paying with your phone has been very, very popular. But mm-hmm. we're going to be seeing a reissue of the $20 bill that's coming up. And we've noticed in other countries a lot of polymer notes, which is a completely different material than the paper notes.
Canada has those.
Yes.
Polymer is just some kind of how would you describe it? The feel.
It feels like a rose coating, like a particular, like a velvety, plasticky finish, like a very smooth, you know, like some of these like phone USB cables, they have that weird sort of silicone texture. It's very smooth and designer. I'm not going to name the phone manufacturer, but it's like that. It's like a very slick, plasticky feeling. I don't know. It leaves your pocket very, very, very easily. And quickly,
wow! That's something as far as different ways that people use notes and money and coins and things like that. And we're fascinated by it all.
Send us your stories if you have stories about currency in your particular country, or maybe you live in a small community in the U.S. and you use an alternative currency. There's a couple places, I know in Massachusetts, the Berkshire bills.
Berkshire bills. I just learned about this.
We were going to go and we were going to check those out, but there are all kinds of ways of handling value in alternative ways. And so please send us a story or tell us your experience using different forms of payment. You know, something other than what we would expect, like your fare card on the transit or just a regular bills and so on. So very interesting. Maybe we'll see some holographic or enhanced coins here in the U.S. soon.
Write to us, oth@2600.com, with your ideas, stories, feedback. We want to hear from you here at Off the Hook. Okay, so other stories. There's a lot going on, actually. We just went through something rather sad, but rather predictable at the same time, and that's this latest Republican move to push back these FCC privacy rules. Now, House Republicans voted yesterday to repeal a set of landmark privacy protections for web users, which is, of course, a sharp pivot away from the internet policies of the Obama administration. And, of course, President Trump is expected to sign the measure. Now, anybody care to address just what these privacy rules gave us? I believe they allowed for internet service providers to not invade our privacy quite so readily as they will now have the freedom to do. Bernie, any insight on this?
Well, what the former Federal Communications Commission, FCC, headed up by Tom Wheeler, who was President Obama's choice of the chairperson of the FCC, Tom Wheeler had put through new regulations, not a law, but regulations by the FCC that would, when it went into effect later this year, which of course never happened because it's going to be trounced by Trump. Basically, the regulations that were to have happened shortly would require ISPs to have your permission. You'd have to opt in order for your web, basically your web browsing history and other related information to be shared with business partners and advertisers of the ISP that you are using. And ISPs were screaming because companies like Google and Facebook didn't have that requirement, but they're not ISPs. So I think Republicans who are pushing this legislation, sponsored it and have voted for it, are comparing apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Facebook and Google are, for the most part, not ISPs.
Right, they're not something that you use from the start, and that covers your entire browsing session and everything you do. And there's a lot of information that they have access to that nobody else would have access to. Now, I know There's all kinds of outrage at this, quite predictably, but there's also some creative responses that people are starting to formulate now. And joining us in the studio is Voltaire to outline at least one of them.
Well, one of them that is making the rounds is a Kickstarter project to, or maybe it's GoFundMe to buy up, quote unquote, buy up individual the browsing habits of the senators and congresspeople that voted for this.
So, the senators and congressmen who voted for this particular rollback of FCC privacy rules, buying their browsing history and doing what with it?
Well, that's the plan, except, like, sadly, that, or maybe for better, that's not really how it works. The ISPs don't actually sell your they have the data, and that's why it's so bad, this law that's passed. But they don't actually, like, sell it to advertisers. So you can't go up to them and say, like, hey, I would like Emmanuel Goldstein's browsing history. How much will it cost me?
Well, then what do they do with it?
They sell like a demographic. Like, they sell your ad space. So if I'm like a soap company and I want to sell soap, it'd be like, let me look up. I'd like to buy the ad space of people on people's browsers that are websites that if they browse based on cleaning tools or something. And then it'll be displayed on there. But the ISPs are the only ones that have your history. So this Kickstarter is not going to go anywhere.
You don't think it will? Okay.
No, I disagree.
Okay, go ahead, Bernie.
Well, I don't know exactly the specific technical means that are done, but several researchers have proven that they've been able to pierce the veil of anonymity that ISPs hold up between their subscribers and advertisers and other business partners. But using a variety of technical techniques. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, me or some of our listeners remember we were talking about Verizon Wireless was inserting something called Super Cookie, which wasn't really a cookie. It was actually changing the URL of every site that you visited by adding a unique identifier to it. But business partners with Verizon Wireless, people, advertisers who were participating in this program, could fairly easily figure out who you were from this so-called anonymous identifier. And I would imagine that whatever techniques Verizon and Comcast and other ISPs start to use, Time Warner, et cetera, I'm sure researchers who are very good at this stuff will be able to pierce the veil of anonymity and determine who is who. So I do think this Kickstarter has promise, and I would love to see the people, the Republicans who have proposed this, who have sponsored this legislation, and big surprise, they actually got a lot of money from the ISPs as campaign donations. I mean, I'm sure it's just a coincidence. I would like them, all their web browsing history to be outed, including everybody who voted for this legislation, to be outed and have all the who knows what kind of really crazy porn fetishes they're browsing. I would love to know.
So yes, the ISPs would be able to pierce the veil of anonymity, by like you discussed, but the Kickstarter and the people that are advertisers that are purchasing this stuff, they're not gonna, the data that they sell them is not sufficient to be able to do that onto an individual basis. Which is not to say it's not scary and this is a horrible law and we should be upset about it.
Let me just ask this. If we went to them and said, will you give us this information, are they allowed under what they just pushed through to do that? If they change their policy, could they sell that directly to us?
Yes, but they probably wouldn't, knowing that we're activists, and that's another reason why this Kickstarter.
Well, we got to trick them into doing it somehow. Then,
is it possible that someone's already gotten a list because they sort of coyly asked for a specific demographic that were perhaps government employees of certain types or public figures and who do certain things based on that would then lead to that assumption that they are those officials?
Alex.
But I think Bernie brings up two really interesting points here. I think the first one, going back to the fact that this congressional use of the Congressional Review Act to repeal rules of the FCC that actually weren't even in effect yet, was ostensibly to put ISPs on the same footing as website operators, because for consumers it was too confusing to have two different sets of rules. One's to an ISP and one that applies to website operators like Google and Facebook, and therefore Google and Facebook are at a distinct – I'm sorry, ISPs are at a distinct disadvantage as opposed to Google and Facebook. That's totally crazy. I mean, that is essentially – and I'll choose my words very carefully here. That's urinating in your pocket and telling you it's raining, given that, you know, the
well,
FCC
well said,
was Pacifica,
yes.
And we are in a Pacifica station here. That's totally insane. It doesn't seem like that should pass the smell test here. But when we go back to the issue of monetizing and anonymizing this data, this is something we actually spoke about at BloomCon last week at a digital forensics conference.
BloomCon?
BloomCon in Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, Bernie.
Is it James Joyce related or Bloomberg News related?
I wish it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Flowers blooming in the spring, maybe.
No, Bloomsburg University in Pennsylvania.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. But in any event, you have the situation where ISPs are really reluctant to engage in something called deep packet inspection, right? They don't want to really be seen to spy on their customers. But they have this budding problem with people like, I don't know if you remember them, Emmanuel, but the MPAA, have you heard of them?
I do have a dim recollection yes. of those clowns,
I
yes.
I think you might, yes, yeah. So the MPAA is very concerned about people using things like Kodi and its add-ons, its unauthorized add-ons.
Kodi. Say a word or two about Kodi.
Kodi is a media player that can be very easily sideloaded onto a number of devices like a Fire Stick. Once Kodi is sideloaded on, it's got a really elegant user interface. It's great for playing movies, for streaming content. And it also has the ability for people to utilize unauthorized add-ons that allow them to stream copyrighted content. Now, that's questionable legality in terms of a copyright infringement. It definitely could constitute something akin to theft of services.
Well, it also allows you to watch television stations in other countries and other cities,
absolutely.
Which I think is a great thing to be able to do. It's got nothing to do with copyright. It's got to do with just seeing what's happening in other parts of the world. I think that's amazing.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're actually right now blocking orders in the UK to prevent some of these streaming sites because people in pubs or pub operators are using them to stream Premier League football games.
Ah.
Illegally,
okay.
Or without paying for them.
Uh-huh.
So in any event, they have this big problem with copyright infringement. They don't know how to solve it. Now, let's assume that they institute something like deep packet inspection, which would be otherwise very, very difficult and expensive to implement, and customers wouldn't want it. Well, they could duly appease somebody like the MPAA that's breathing down their neck, and then all of a sudden they have a lot of data about its customer base and application-level data about what kind of apps people are using and when and where and how frequently and when you read the New York Times and when you read the New York Post and on what devices as well. Well, that data can now be monetized.
And what stories you read, what you're interested
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely.
To say nothing of it being leaked or otherwise compromised. I mean, you just store a bunch of data around like that. There's inevitable chance of someone who is not authorized or that your institution is going to leak it in some way.
Well, speaking of that, now let's say that this data is sold to a third party. It's packaged and bundled and sold and supposedly anonymized in certain respects. But we don't really know what level of data is going to be packaged and bought and sold in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sold to a third party. And then another third party, namely, let's say, a government agency.
Yes.
Or a contractor to a government agency buys that particular bundle of data.
Well, if the NYPD is just interested in seeing what people in this building are doing, they could buy it too.
They could buy it.
Uh-huh. Is there anything in what they just pushed through Congress saying that they have to anonymize it?
I don't believe so, but they probably would. From the ISP standpoint, from a business standpoint, I think they would. But this also raises another huge issue, which is if we have only one ISP because everyone keeps merging, then we have no choice, right? Then we just have to deal with this invasion of privacy at the customer level.
Mm-hmm.
We're the ones who are going to suffer if there's no competition here.
Well, it's amazing to me. This just went through yesterday, and I believe, Bernie, correct me if I'm wrong, this was a completely Republican bill. No Democrats supported it?
Yeah, it was straight down party lines, Emmanuel. There were, I don't believe any Democrats voted for this, which is kind of surprising because a lot of Democrats do accept money, a lot of money, from internet service providers and other folks in the tech industry. But this was such an egregious violation of Americans' privacy that I think Democrats actually wanted to stand up for something they purport to believe in, which is consumer protection.
Well, so, just a little history here, though. This is something that the Obama administration pushed through that's now being pushed pushed away, repealed. So before the Obama administration did this, are we pretty much in the same boat that we will be in soon when this is signed by Trump?
We actually may be even farther backwards than we were before then. I haven't read the language of the legislation that's now, and it's going to be modified for sure, because it has to go, there's got to be a Senate version before it goes to the president kind of thing. So we don't know what the final language of this is yet, but basically it's kind of like an Obamacare repeal and replace. They're repealing the privacy regulations that the Obama administration's FCC chair put through, and replacing it with something that's probably more odious than what we had even before that.
Don't they realize how evil this makes them look, though? They don't seem to care.
No, they don't care.
Wow.
They care about getting money from their campaign contributors, some of the largest of whom are internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, Time Warner, etc. That's what they care about.
This bill, the Obama administration policy, actually never went into effect. It was the bill that just passed is canceling it from going into effect. So we never actually had this privacy to begin with.
Oh, so we never even achieved the point that Obama administration was trying to get us to.
Exactly.
That's right.
Wow. We were about to.
So close. So very close.
If it looks evil, they would probably say that it's because we're looking at it wrong.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, one more point. Voltaire.
So this was on party grounds, the vote, but we end up getting like 34 Republicans to vote against the bill, which I think it just speaks to how powerful the activist groups like Fight for the Future and the EFF.
34 Republicans in the House voted against this. Exactly. I wasn't aware of that. I thought it was completely all Republicans voted for it. Okay,
only,
that's good.
Yeah, the people that voted for it were only Republicans, but it's great that so many voted against it, and it speaks to the power of pro-internet.
Absolutely. Same thing with healthcare and all kinds of different battles that are going on right now. And let's get their names and scratch them off the list of people whose internet history will be obtaining some, one way or another. Wow. Okay. There's something else that we want to talk about. In fact, Alex, that's what you're here to talk about, and that's this case going on right here in New York, having to do with Bitcoin, and some regulations that are being directed at Bitcoin processors, I believe. Can you briefly explain this to us in a way that your grandmother would understand?
I will try. Absolutely. And I have explained this to her, so yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. This is a very interesting case. It's entitled Theo Chino versus the Department of Financial Services, the New York Department of Financial Services, and it essentially is about the regulation of cryptocurrencies in New York State.
Okay.
The Department of Financial Services, you know, oversees banks, insurance agencies, anybody that essentially has to do with financial products, things like that. You know, for instance, insurance companies, they are regulated to the extent to which they have to keep reserves on file, things like that. So what they promulgated a couple of years ago was the requirement for anybody who transmits or is involved in the processing or the receipt for transmission of cryptocurrencies. And they seem to specifically target Bitcoin as well. Now, this particular lawsuit by Theo Chino, and he is the sole plaintiff in this lawsuit. Nobody has joined him, and that's an interesting point that we'll get to later. He's challenged this, and it is currently before Judge Billings in New York Supreme Court. It's at the motion to dismiss side. The New York Attorney General is opposing Theo Chino, and what Theo is arguing is rather interesting. He's arguing that New York really has no authority to regulate at the state level Bitcoins, that this goes way well over and outside of the ambit of the Department of Financial Services. And moreover, there really isn't the research to support the need for this particular regulation. Now, on that point, one very interesting affidavit was filed by a lawyer by the name of Jim Harper in support of Theo Chino. And he had essentially recited a series of facts where he had asked for the research underlying the Department of Financial Services needs statement that there needs to be a regulation. And DFS told him that they would give it to him essentially within 20 days, and at the expiration of that 20 days, they said, sorry, we're going to need 120 days. And then at the end of that 120 days, they never provided anything. So does it not necessarily seem like they've put in the right amount of research in order to engage in this level of regulation? It also has a really deleterious effect on the ability for smaller players in the cryptocurrency market to join in, join in the fun, so to speak. Because the regulations are pretty onerous. You know, there's a $5,000 fee just to apply. It's like getting your car inspected.
Okay, well, just to be clear, though, we're not talking about people that want to accept Bitcoin. We're talking about people who want to what precisely?
Well, they if they're processing it, essentially. And that's what Theo was about to do.
Processing meaning, okay, so someone else got paid in Bitcoin, and now they submit it to you to you're like
sort of acting as some sort of intermediary where you hold on to it, you store it, you transmit it for these particular types of stores. And what Theo was going to do was very innovative, and it was to establish a company that allowed bodegas to accept Bitcoins.
Okay.
And he performed a lot of research. In fact, he had contracts, so I believe, with 7 different bodegas in order to do this until the license requirement called the bit license requirement was promulgated, which took him essentially out of the playing field.
Well, okay, now, so this license requirement just came out of nowhere? Was it in response to what he was trying to do?
Not necessarily in response. This was under some consideration, and there was a commenting period for a period of time. And I believe the Bitcoin Foundation had made some serious comments on the DFS regulation and also requested their research, which was never given to them. And then this regulation was promulgated, and now everybody has to comply with it. So it has this interesting effect of forcing out all the smaller competitors in this particular market and forcing out of New York State a lot of innovative companies that could be employing people, could be doing really innovative research, that could be doing some very cool things in New York. So everybody else is going elsewhere because of this onerous requirement. The only people that are sticking around are the bigger players that have essentially venture capital money backing them, and they're not joining in on the fight quite likely.
They already have.
Because they've already got the license. They've got the money to do it. They have the ability to engage in the very strict level of compliance that DFS is requiring for anybody who would be a licensee. And so this is at an interesting juncture right now where apparently at the last court hearing, Judge Billings requested oral argument on this motion to dismiss. This case is going to be heard pretty soon. I believe it's May 7th in front of Judge Billings' part in New York Supreme Court, which is over at 60 Center Street, spelled the British way.
Oh, can we all go?
Of course. We can all go.
We should.
You want to go?
Well, I'll
let's go.
BAI listener. Well, I don't know if that would help the case, but no, of course. Not to have all our listeners show up. I don't know, maybe, but we definitely should be following this. But
absolutely,
this raises all kinds of questions. What do other states do? What happens in New Jersey? What happens in Connecticut? Are they just not taking part in these kinds of regulations?
In New Jersey, if you use cryptocurrency, you go directly to jail.
I don't know if you're joking or not.
I'm kidding. That's right.
You lawyers have this stone face. You never know.
Well, the innovation, the point about innovation, I think, is really important because of the emergence of this technology and where it is in development. And by having entrenched sort of a few companies maintain a sort of pseudo monopoly by having that entrance into the being a transactor or processor being very limited will create this technology historically as in a very specific way that maybe one or another company have designed and not much further. And for you to really explore how it's going to be used and how it's going to be adopted and how accessible it is, you need sort of a level playing field. And this is sort of the argument Theo's making is that this is the first step in making it onerous for anyone to gain access and compete and innovate and thus push the limits of what this is capable of in the market.
Well, you've hit on a really, I think, smart point here, because the argument that the Attorney General is making to try to dismiss this case, one of the arguments that they're making is that Theo Chino, as an individual and sole plaintiff, does not necessarily have standing to challenge this regulation because he doesn't have a stake in the market. Even though he had 7 contracts with bodegas to provide what appears to be a small service.
That sounds like a stake to me.
Absolutely, it sounds like
there's opportunity costs, of course. Given that he did research, he could have put together a business plan based on that research, which would then at least assume that there's some sort of economic a reason for him to go forward, yeah. and thus a loss if he can't.
Yeah, I think this lawsuit has legs. I think it's really important. I think it's being well litigated. And I think we should all show up for the next hearing.
Go ahead, Voltaire.
Do you think the motivation for banning this is for consumer protection or like tax collection reasons, or do you think it's because of the fear of Bitcoin as like enabling like pure things that are banned for puritanical reasons, like drugs or other things?
I think it is a form of paternalism that may not be required in this particular situation. In Britain, it would be called a version of the nanny state, right, where DFS wants to step in because they think consumers need to be protected, that somehow these currencies may drop in value if their exchange isn't regulated by somebody watching with a very, very close eye. And it raises, I think, a very fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of Bitcoins as well, because Bitcoins aren't necessarily exactly a legal tender or form of currency.
Well, it's interesting because, we've taken Bitcoins now for a number of years. In fact, many of our Hope attendees paid in Bitcoin, and our store still accepts Bitcoin. And we had a lot of pushback from people that were wary of us doing that in the first place. Everything from people saying that somehow it's not carbon friendly because computers are used to mine bitcoins or whatever, to people saying that underworld mob bosses use Bitcoin, and in fact our bank even warned us that this could be a suspicious transaction when it's completely legitimate, and we've done quite well with Bitcoin. It's something that is, I think, the present and the future, and it's only the beginning. This kind of thing we need to be encouraging, not trying to over-restrict and intimidate people out of.
Yeah, and exactly the reason to allow this to be experimented with and exist in the market is because it allows for people to access it and use it in ways other than being some dark lord of the under dark nets or whatever you're doing. If you have to go all the way there to use this, it's going to limit the amount of those types of people and with those type of ability. But by allowing small businesses and people with ideas like this to get out there and try it, then you can come back and maybe have an educated perspective on how it will be used and potentially abused, of course, in the market. But you don't know that unless you give it the opportunity. And this seems like a really ham-handed way to cut that off before it even happens.
Bernie, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, any of our listeners that are more interested in following this and finding out when the next hearing is going to be, that I think we should all attend, the website is called www.article78againstnyfs.com. That's the New York Department of Financial Services. Article 78 against NYDFS.com. Or just email us at oth@2600.com, and we will send you the URL so you can keep updated on it. I think this is a really important case because it really determines whether our freedom, our financial freedom with regard to anonymous currency is going to be exist in New York State. Fortunately, this isn't happening in other states, but it's happening in New York, which is bad.
Let me correct myself, by the way. I am looking at my notes, and I believe the hearing is going to be on 4 May, not 7 May. So I believe it is 4 May in front of Judge Billings.
Can we just verify, guys? Somebody with internet access, verify that, because we do want to give out correct information.
Absolutely, and you can see that. And this Article 78, the reason why that's in the domain name, is an Article 78 proceeding is the sort of legal mechanism in New York by which you challenge an administrative agency's decision-making process. That's why it's an Article 78. So the other fight on this, if we lose at the Article 78, I say we meaning Theo because we're obviously on his side, if that's lost, there is still the opportunity to appeal that decision to the First Department, which is the appellate court for Manhattan, essentially. And then from there, you can appeal to the Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York. And from the Court of Appeals, it can go to the Supreme Court. So the Article 78 may not be the be-all, end-all, but I do think it does present a viable opportunity to strike down this offensive regulation.
Yes, and it's something that As far as we know, it's unique to New York. I'm not sure about other states.
Other states have attempted to promulgate some kind of regulation of cryptocurrency and decided to shelve it, like California, where they decided that they needed to really understand this a bit better before they started regulating it, that what they had on the books wasn't necessarily fit for a long-lasting regulatory framework.
And maybe we should look at what other countries do as well. Maybe some countries are getting it right. Maybe some countries are going completely down the wrong road we don't want to go down as well.
True.
And Rob, you have an update?
Yep, just confirming the info. It's from Article 78 against NYDFS.com. The hearing date is Thursday, May the 4th, 2017. May the 4th, Star Wars Day. 9:30 a.m. In front of Justice Lucy Billings, Part 46, Room 204 at the courthouse on 71 Thomas Street, New York, New York, 10013.
9:30 in the morning?
9:30 in the morning.
That's dedication.
We show up as stormtroopers that day.
Wow. Thomas Street, is that the street with the crazy phone company building? Oh, it's worth going just to see that.
33 Thomas Street.
Yeah, go see that building, folks. It's in Mr. Robot, too, I think. And it's just one of the amazing brutalist architecture examples in the city. I'm sorry, I'm straying off topic here. Definitely learn more about this. In fact, I know Theo comes to the New York City 2600 meetings, take place the first Friday of every month at our new location on half a block from the old location, 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue. If you want to sign on and help out in any way, that's a great way to get involved as well. And, we love hearing people challenging systems in various ways. It's so good to get involved. And the fact that it's even gone this far, that someone isn't just thrown out immediately, that we can get to a point where you're in New York Supreme Court. That's where we are, right? Is that unusual, Alex? I mean, you're a lawyer. Does this kind of thing happen often?
Well, New York Supreme Court is interesting because it's actually the lowest level court in New York, but it's called the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court is the lowest level court?
That's right, yeah.
Wait, I don't understand that. That makes no sense.
It's a misnomer.
It's right. Supreme.
It is supreme in its ability to get things wrong sometimes. But it
the Supreme Burger is better than the Jumbo Burger or the Deluxe Burger. I mean, that's just a fact. You learn that in school.
That's true. I've never heard of a Jumbo Court though. But
I'm sure
my days before they're over, there will be something like that. But no, Supreme Court is essentially the trial level court in New York.
Uh-huh.
And then from there you have the Appellate Division and then the Court of Appeals, which is the highest level court. So it's a bit of a misnomer. You end up in New York Supreme Court quite frequently when you're litigating, but the fact that the judge is requesting oral argument on this means that the litigation really has legs.
Interesting. Voltaire.
How does this relate to the recent banning of the ETF fund for Bitcoin?
I don't know. To be honest, that's the best answer I can give.
Well, what is this you're referring to?
Yes.
It's basically a company wanted to be able to make it so that you could buy a stock whose price reflected that of Bitcoin to make it easier to speculate at Bitcoin. I forget if it was the state or the federal government said regulators said that it didn't meet the standards and they said you can't do it.
It's a different case, different issue, but it's still interesting.
It sounds like you need to go to that hearing and have a conversation with a bunch of people there that are real experts on this, and maybe at the 2600 meeting as well coming up this April, a week from this Friday coming up. We're just about out of time, so we need to move on out of here. But please write to us if you have any feedback on this, ideas, questions, corrections, whatnot. OTH@2600.com is our email address. Remember, if you pledge during our winter fund drive, please make sure that pledge is paid so that when we ask for the names and addresses next week, your name is on there if you pledged for one of the items that we offered. We'll be back again next week with another exciting edition of Off the Hook. And until then, this is Emmanuel for Off the Hook. Have a good night. Oh, yeah. And, Voltaire, you have an announcement about the Twitter account, or a re-announcement, because we've announced this before.
Yes, our Twitter handle is @HackerRadioShow, so please
follow. Well, the ad is assumed. Everyone gets an ad. Hacker Radio Show, that is our Twitter account. So join that to get the latest updated news on all kinds of things that are happening with us.
Correct.
And we'll see you next week. Good night.
Paul Fisher from WBAI then and WBAI now. Tired of pesky programs interrupting our fascinating fundraising drives? No problem. Don't touch that dial. We can sell you conspiracies and miracle cures till the sun goes supernova. Or you can help WBAI again become a station known for programs, not just products. How? Thought you'd never ask. Become a BAI buddy. That's a minimum $10 a month donation for each of the next 12 months. Help end the heartbreak of psoriasis cures and other lotions, potions, and nostrums sold on the radio by sending us money to make radio. Go to WBAI.org, our website, and become a BAI buddy. Well, I don't know if I'm walking on solid
ground. Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI in New York. Enjoy.
March the 29th, 2017, and it's time for the Personal Computer Show. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. The program is on each Wednesday on PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. The radio program is streamed live on WBAI.org, and our website is PCRadioShow.org. When we were originally canceled by WBAI in August of last year, we accepted the opportunity to be on PRN.FM. When WBAI then rescinded the cancellation but moved us to a later hour, we decided to continue at both venues. We are appreciative of PRN.FM. On WBAI, there is, unfortunately, uncertainty due to various reasons. Scheduled regular broadcast programming on WAI has been operationally erratic and inconsistent. At the present time, the regular broadcast of the Personal Computer Show is the same for PRN.FM and WBAI. The exceptions are when we are preempted on WBAI or when we have been scheduled for WBAI fundraising. When we are preempted on WBAI, we continue to do regular programming on PRN.FM. The broadcast is available for download from our website PCRadioShow.org, and it is maintained on the PRN.FM archives. We recently have been experiencing irregular broadcasting and radio silence when we are scheduled to be on the air on WBAI. The regular program, however, is aired on PRN.FM, and broadcast is available for download from PRN.FM as well as from PCRadioShow.org. When WBAI is in membership drive or fundraising mode, each contains different material. We broadcast on WBAI a different program from that of what's on PRN.FM. In the past, a very popular format of the show has been listeners calling in with their comments and questions. The station now has but one telephone line in the studio. We are exploring what options are available to best serve you, the listeners. We welcome you, the listeners, your comments, and feedback to help us decide how we might move forward. Let us know by email your 2 cents worth by sending your email to pcradio@pcradioshow.org.
Asked me, what's that clitter clatter at the end of your pieces previous weeks? And I told them, well, that's what a typewriter sounds like. You've been typing the script up, and then you read it to make sure it's good. And they constantly ask me, what's a typewriter?
I was just going to say, when you say typewriter, at least, well, for those of our generation, we know what a typewriter is, but many people would look at you and say, what is a typewriter?
They used a word processor, they used to computers, but typewriter is something that goes clickety-clack, clickety-clack, ding. You know, I do want to comment on your last point that you made in that intro, Hank. We have here at PRN a real radio studio, something we're not used to at BAI. And, of course, we not only have microphones and headsets, but we even have a thing that Alexander Graham Bell invented. They call it down here telephones. They have a plural on it so that you can have many calls coming in. The only problem is that the calls are only live during the 6 to 7 hour that we're broadcasting. So what I want to know from those of you who are listening right now, not listening on the podcast, not listening on the recording, would you like to have open phones here so you can call in and make your comments, ask your questions? If so, if the answer is yes, you would like to call in and you'd like us to give out the 800 number so you could call in toll-free, why, then I'd like you to write to us, pcradio@gmail.com, pcradio@gmail.com, and tell us what you think about that. Another way that we could possibly do it is to have you email in or Twitter in your questions, and we answer them live on the radio. But I'm not happy with that. I like the idea of telephones. If you agree with me, please write in. One other thing I'd like to point out is that last week's show, we had a normal show in all respects. The only thing that wasn't normal about it was the way it was fouled up at the BAI radio station. And we had covered some pretty interesting things. Alfred Poor had his normal column on wearable tech, and Joe Ruskowski came up with some really good simple computer tips. And Marty Winston did a lovely essay, a really interesting essay on home automation. All of those are available on the podcast. You can get that either here at the PRN archives or at the our archives at pcradioshow.org. And I hope you go over and listen to those.
You know, Joe, I was reading some news item, and I looked at it. Oh, come on. Hey. You know, that saying, fool me once, but not a second time, you're not going to even fool me the first time. And it was a CNBC news item saying that, it was a news item. I said, effective April 1st, you're not going to get me on this April Fool's joke. Then I see the same thing on MSNBC. Then I see that it was in Forbes. Hey, wait a minute. It's no joke. You know what? There's no joke anymore. This Saturday, which is April 1st, Amazon will start collecting state sales tax nationwide, and for states that don't have a sales tax, they're going to collect a use tax.
And it's not just the states. It's the thousands and thousands and thousands of local localities that also have taxes. For example, New York State has a sales tax. New York City has its own sales tax. On top of it, Amazon somehow is... The collecting of it, as Hank explained to me, is not a big deal. The collecting of it is simply a lookup table. When each one of the hundreds of millions of orders go out, they look up what tax might or might not be due and whether or not there's a state use tax and, you know, things like that that might slow down your order by 5 or 6 months, but don't worry about it. The problem is that after they collect these millions of pennies, they got to then write checks. They have to send them back or electronically transfer them. And pretty soon you're going to find all the prices at Amazon are going up.
Well, you know, Joe, one of the things that people are not aware of is that there are certain states that do not charge a sales tax, but there is a use tax. Can you explain to them what a use tax is?
Yeah, as far as I know, the only state that doesn't have a use tax is Nevada. But here in New York, a use tax is if a piece of...
Item that is sold and the...
Hank, it used to be just if a capital goods was sold out of the state and brought into the state to be used, that automobile, that x-ray machine, that transporter would have a use tax that was, strangely enough, equal to the sales tax. Now it's the use tax is being applied, at least here in New York State, to anything that has a sales tax. If the sales tax is not paid because it's bought out of state, if it's brought into the state to be used or consumed, it has a use tax equal to the sales tax. But there's a trick there, because I asked the question, well, is the state, which is collecting the use tax, going to give back that percentage of the use tax to each of the localities? And they said, probably not.
Well, you know, government to government is an honest thing, isn't it?
Government is the oddest thing, yes.
You know, with Google, one of the things that Google is famous for is that they have many interesting and very useful applications, and they have new features that kind of get out there. And however, they always seem to go out with any official announcement or fanfare, and it almost always start off as a beta product. And then it becomes an official product. Sometimes it takes years to do it. Gmail is a good example of it. And in some cases, the application can morph into another product, and you find out about it afterwards, or they just drop the product completely, and that's the way Google operates. And one of the things that kind of snuck in there that some people were not aware of was Google Docs. Now, Google Docs is, let me say, it's a scaled-down version of Office Functions compared to, like, say, Microsoft Office. And if you need not all of the features in Microsoft Office, it's something that you might want to consider using. And the problem that most people complain about Office Docs is you got to be online to use it. Did you know that you could use Google Docs in offline mode if you're using the Chrome browser? And this started about, a year and a half ago. But how many people knew about it?
Well, the problem there, Hank, is a lot of people, like me, don't really use Google Docs. So I wasn't surprised that you can use it with offline with Chrome or with Firefox.
Wait. They only made that announcement that Firefox will have that capability where you can run Google Docs offline. However, you know what the catch is in all this? You have to run Google Docs through a browser to run offline. Isn't that weird? You got to go to a browser to run offline?
Well, yes and no. That's not what bothers me. What bothers me is I can't run it offline on all of my browsers, or I need a specific browser to run it online or offline or in between the lines. The whole thing is way too confusing
for
me.
Wait. There's a catch in all this, too. You know that.
The catch is I'm supposed to know what I'm talking about.
No. You know what the catch is?
What?
That for you to be able to run Google Docs offline, if you were to sign off your browser, which most people do, you know, for good security, you want to close down the machine, you sign off and so on. You don't sign off the Chrome browser, and in the future, you don't sign off the Firefox browser. You have to leave it in on mode so you can run it offline. And here's a catch. If the online capability all of a sudden becomes available, it switches automatically to online so it can sync everything, and you don't know whether you're online or offline. I
don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, you know what? I think that there is a much better solution, and we talked about it in the past. The product was called Kingsoft Office. It's been renamed now WPS Office.
Does that stand for Word Perfect Suite?
Word Perfect, they're like instead of .doc like .docs, in Word Perfect, it's .wps. No, in this case,